Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 8th of September. Last week came reports that Arctic sea ice is melting at an alarming rate, and some scientists have little hope that the downward trend can be reversed before the ice disappears altogether. The National Snow and Ice Data Center in Colorado released its latest ice report last week, showing that ice coverage in the region is at the second lowest level in 30 years. And our guest this hour says it's very different from in the past when you had a low year and then you tended to rebound. We haven't been doing that anymore. 2008 is now in second place for the lowest amount of sea ice since satellite measurements were first taken in 1979. And with several weeks left in the melt season, 2008 could still surpass September of 2007 for the lowest amount of sea ice since satellite measurements were first taken in 1979. We also had reports last week that open water now stretches all the way around the Arctic, making it possible for the first time in human history to circumnavigate the North Pole, and there are companies that will take advantage of that. And also that animals that depend on the ice, polar bear and seals, are finding it harder and harder to survive as the winter ice shrinks and it takes longer to refreeze in the fall. Joining us this hour to talk about these remarkable and alarming developments is Professor Julian Struva, research scientist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center. She's been doing research on diagnosing the declining Arctic sea ice cover using a combination of modeling and observational data, examining changes in climate variables using satellite imagery. She has briefed former Vice President Al Gore on Arctic sea ice conditions and the relationships to climate model projections. She has filmed for Discovery Science a special on climate stories of 2007 and has written extensively on the Arctic's shrinking sea ice cover and what it means for currently affected communities and animal species like polar bears. Professor Julian Struva, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
That was a fairly dramatic report that you released last week, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, but it's not that surprising with what we know has been happening in the Arctic. We knew at the beginning of this summer that we were starting out with a very, very thin ice cover. And so we anticipated that we would have a lot of ice loss this year. I think it's a little surprising that we didn't lose as much ice as quickly as we did last year. And there's certain reasons for that. One of the reasons was last year we just had this perfect storm that set up that favored a lot of ice loss. You had very warm atmospheric and oceanic temperatures. You had very strong winds that pushed the ice away from the coast of Siberia and Alaska towards the North Pole. You had very sunny conditions. So all of these things sort of kind of added together to favor such a large amount of ice loss last summer. And this summer conditions have been very different. We've actually had atmospheric circulation patterns, which typically would help us have a lot more ice than normal. But because the ice is still very, very thin, even so, we still have lost a lot of ice this year, and we are now the second lowest on record. And, you know, there's still a couple more weeks left of the melt season, and we could still surpass last year.
Mm-hmm. For the lowest amount of sea ice taken since the measurements were started in 1979, is that the year?
Well, 1979 is sort of the beginning of the modern satellite data record. But we can go back until about 1953, using other observations from ship reports as well as aircraft observations and even some earlier satellite missions. And if you do that, we're actually the lowest in at least since 1953.
Mm-hmm. There is now another report that came last week that, and tell me what the significance is of this, open water now stretching all the way around the Arctic, making it possible for the first time in human history to circumnavigate the North Pole.
Well, I wouldn't say you can go all the way around the Arctic. I suppose, I mean, there's still ice attached near Greenland. But it is the first time that we have seen both the Northern Sea Route, which is what goes along the coast of Russia, and the Northwest Passage, which goes along the coast of Canada, they're both open at the same time. And this is the first time since at least routine monitoring began by the Canadian Ice Service and other national ice institutes where we see them open on both sides this year.
Mm-hmm. And there are already plans, I understand, that companies from Bahrain with the unlikely name of the Beluga Shipping Company are going to be starting to use that passage as early as this year.
Yeah, there's a lot of different companies very interested right now in the Arctic, because certainly it will shorten the trade routes between Asia and Europe and North America. And, you know, it's not just the increased shipping from trade routes. There's a lot of people interested now in drilling in the Arctic, because there is a lot of oil estimated to be in these Arctic seas. And so there's a lot of companies positioning, getting ready to drill in the U.S. And in Russia, they're already drilling, and they're ramping up their operations a lot more.
Mm-hmm. You know, I must tell you that because we tend to have certain animals that we really care about, and you look at their plight and say how tragic this is, I know that you have done research on animals that depend on the ice, polar bear and seals. And this, actually, I dreamt about this last night. It so entered my subconscious that observers from the U.S. federal government were doing a whale survey and reported seeing 9 polar bears swimming off Alaska's northwest coast. Mm-hmm. The bears between 20 and 100 kilometers from shore. Some were swimming north, trying to reach the polar ice shelf, which was more than 600 kilometers distant. They can swim 100 kilometers, but they become dangerously weak from the ordeal, and they were thinking of going much farther than that. They will die, won't they?
Yeah, I don't see how they could survive if they're that far from shore and then that far from the ice edge. This year, the polar bear is certainly, you know, near Barrow, Alaska, and all along the Alaskan and sort of Canadian coast there. The ice retreated very early this year in that area. So either they got stranded on land without, you know, access to the ice, or they got stranded very far in the ocean as the ice broke up all around them. And I know that for every week that a polar bear does not hunt, and seal is, of course, their favorite food, which they can only access if they're out on the ice with those seals, they lose about 20 pounds. And so what's happening is these bears are becoming really, really thin, and they're not able to reproduce anymore. So there's sort of two effects happening with the loss of the sea ice. They can't get to their food source, and they can't reproduce anymore.
Hmm. So are you disturbed? We got to enter politics in this, because I've been wondering how this is going to play out. I was interested that John McCain's position all along has been about the integrity of science, about global warming, and that reports are, particularly British reports, who are very upset about this, the selection of Sarah Palin, a complete reversal from that position, mm-hmm. that he evidently, McCain, went to the South Pole in 2006 to visit with scientists who are studying climate change. She believes that, you know, there's some question as to whether or not this is man-made. This is a substantial difference about from the two parties who are on the Republican ticket, isn't it?
It is, and I thought, you know, either if it was McCain or Obama as president, we're going to at least have a big improvement, I think, in the White House regarding how serious, you know, these effects are, and trying to get more on board with trying to do things to help curb our greenhouse gas emissions and move more towards alternative energy. And, you know, I think it's pretty transparent why Palin was picked, but it definitely scares me a bit. Her policies and her anti-environmental views are very much against, of course, what I know from the research that I do, and I realize now how important and how serious this issue is becoming, because the Arctic is really sort of our, you know, this is where the changes are happening first, but this is what's going to come for everybody else in the near future. As soon as we start losing all that ice, and we're on this trajectory towards losing that ice cover completely, whether it happens in 10 years or whether it happens in 20 years, there's nothing right now in our system that's going to stop it from happening, because we continue to do business as usual. And when that happens, you're just going to have this incredibly amplified warming that's going to happen in the Arctic that's going to translate to, you know, climate down for the lower latitudes as well. And we don't even fully understand the implications of this yet, because we haven't been around when this happened last. And so we really don't understand what this is going to mean for the rest of us. But we know a huge climate shift is about to happen.
Mm-hmm. And are there, I don't know if you want to put this in percentage terms or what, are there a significant number of scientists who would disagree with what you're just saying? Are there a number of people who will say this is not caused by global warming, there's no need for concern, we need to drill, we don't need to put polar bears on endangered species lists or seals, that it's all overblown?
Well, I personally feel that there's probably a political agenda there, and it's not being driven by the science. I mean, the science, for many years, we've had this theory that has told us that if we increase concentrations of greenhouse gases in our atmosphere, that the planet is going to warm, and that when this does happen, it's going to be first manifested up in the polar regions. So basically, the observations are now in line with what the theory's been telling us, and the scary thing that's happening, too, I think, is that, you know, if we run all of our most sophisticated climate models, they all show this happening, even though all of these models could be in their own phase of natural variability. They could be showing increases in ice or decreases, but they're all showing decreases, which really helps to implicate greenhouse gases as the driving factor for what we're seeing today. But none of the models are able to capture how quickly the ice is disappearing. They're very actually quite conservative. So, you know, this is a big change that's happening, and it's outpacing everything that we thought. So, but what's happening is in line with what we've known from theory for, you know, decades now, what could happen.
Mm-hmm. I had this dream last night, which I know was significant in some way. Those polar bears just stayed in my mind for some reason, and I was riding on the backs of one of the polar bears through the Arctic, and we finally got to a polar ice cap, and somebody came up in a boat and got me to the, I don't even know my geography of this area, the University of Alaska, where I proceeded to have a conference with John McCain and Barack Obama to work the whole thing out. Yeah, it's obviously going in the deep recesses of my mind somehow, huh?
Well, I mean, the polar bears, I mean, there's something that the general public can sort of grab onto. I mean, they're such a remarkable animal. They're so uniquely adapted to survive in that environment. And the idea of those bears not being able to survive this rapid climate change that's happening up north is quite disheartening.
Yeah.
And, it you know, personally, I don't see how they could survive if that ice goes away, because their primary food source is the seals. And, you know, besides not being able to access the seals are starting to suffer, too, because they spend their whole life tied to the sea ice as well. They give birth to their pups under the snow mounds on the ice. So when that ice breaks up earlier and that snow melts earlier, those pups get dumped into the ocean without being fully weaned from their moms. And so they're actually suffering, too, in their population numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And so that whole food chain, and then, you know, it's linked to so many other species. So, you know, you're basically changing the whole ecosystem of the Arctic right now.
Mm-hmm. I know there are some of your colleagues at the National Snow and Ice Data Center who are providing to us in the last week or so in a catastrophic scenario that we've already gone beyond the tipping point here, and it's a downward spiral. You don't necessarily adhere to that drastic a scenario, do you?
Well, I don't really want to believe that that there's no hope left. And I don't think we could really say that with any confidence either. If you run your climate model simulations and you try to reduce your CO2 levels in the atmosphere, and you try to bring those levels back to levels, say, even in the 1980s, for example, you do see a slowing down of the ice loss. It's not like it's, okay, once we, you know, where we're at today, we can't go back. I don't think that's the case. I think it's important for people to understand there's, you know, you have a lot of natural variability, and you also have this forced change. So you have this long-term downward trend that we're seeing today in the Arctic that is fueled in large part by the man-made changes that are happening on our planet. But there's a lot of natural variability on top of that. And so, you know, if natural variability goes in the same phase as this forced change, we're going to lose a lot of ice. Natural variability could also counteract that forced change for a few years. So if we were to make changes and we try to reduce our carbon footprint, and you have natural variability also working against reducing that ice, you could maybe help recover it somewhat. And, you know, if we continue these efforts, eventually maybe you could recover it so that it is back to levels that we're used to seeing in the 1950s, the 1970s, for example.
Mm. And so what do we have to do to accomplish that?
I think we need really good leadership.
Huh?
I really think we do. I think the American people, we want to do the right thing. You know, we're inherently good people, and, you know, if we knew that our actions were causing so much damage, if we could see it, you know, in our own backyard, for example, we would want to make the changes. I think people feel sometimes a little lost. They don't know what to do. I know the skeptics try really hard to confuse the general public and make them think that there is no consensus in the science,
right,
or that our data is wrong, or, you know, there's all kinds of things being said. But, you know, really, if the kinds of environmental changes that are happening in the Arctic today were happening in our backyards, people would be making changes, and they would be demanding that their leaders, you know, enforce changes to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're a little disconnected right now from it because we still have it pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And until we start to suffer, you know, it's just hard without the leadership, I think, to help push our country in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Or we have to realize that polar bears and seals have a language that we can decipher, right? They need to talk to us.
If they could talk to us, yeah, maybe we would listen a little bit better, but...
Yeah.
I think some people feel like, well, species go extinct all the time, and that is true. Yeah. And they will continue to go extinct. But, you know, if we as an intelligent being can help change that and help keep species on this planet that we care about, you know, why shouldn't we try to do that?
Mm-hmm.
And eventually it's going to come down to our own survivability, I think. You know, we're relatively new species on this planet, and, you know, the rapid climate change that we're going through right now is going to start affecting all of us quite dramatically, I think.
Let's welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Professor Julian Struva, research scientist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center. She's doing research on diagnosing the declining Arctic sea ice cover using a combination of modeling and observational data. Looking at two big pieces of news last week, a report that the Arctic sea ice is melting at an alarming rate, and there are some scientists who have little hope the downward trend can be reversed. We also had news that open water now stretches all the way around the Arctic, making it possible for the first time in human history to circumnavigate the North Pole. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, feel free to do that. That's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, and let's start with Jackie from Northwest Illinois. Hi, Jackie.
Good morning. I hate to say thank you for the program because it is a sad program, but nonetheless, thank you for providing us with information. We can't be informed unless we have information to work with. I'd like to register a vote of despair here because I am a minister, and I'm not going to say what minister, what denomination, but I'll tell you, I don't see people walking their talk. I don't see people who are informed and people who know better doing the things. There's a small group of people, but there are people who are not doing what they need to do. They aren't cutting down on their CO2. They tell me they're so concerned about the future generations, but they keep doing things that are for their immediate well-being. And I'm really torn about that because I know it's hard these days to make ends meet. But on the other hand, when they don't do anything or little things at all that could make a difference, I'm really distressed. And I'm typically a very hopeful person. I even teach workshops on despair, but increasingly my sadness for the balance of life, other beings on this planet, is being decimated, whittled away, and this news is just all the more statement. People just are not walking their talk, and I don't need a response to it. And I hear all the good things that your guest speaker has said, but I don't feel very... I just wanted to say that.
And thank you for the call. Thank you. I would imagine a lot of people feel that way, Julian.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think... You know, it is hard because we don't have a whole lot of incentives in this country either to make changes that we know are going to benefit our environment. A lot of the tax credits are going away for solar, for example. And so, you know, we need to have incentives to help people do the right thing, I think. And that's where good leadership can really help in this regard. Because I think that's what's needed. I mean, yeah, there are people that are suffering right now and they're not going to probably make changes because it might be too expensive for them to do the right thing. And that's where we just need good government leadership.
Can you talk about, and I don't want to signal out a party, but it is interesting when you watch the Republican National Convention, this theme, and it's a theme in Washington as they keep on the floor talking about energy issues, this drill, baby, drill, drill, baby, drill, all the placards that were all over and the enthusiasm with which people are chanting that. Can you talk about where that's coming from and what that means in terms of the Arctic?
Well, I do know, I don't know the exact amount of oil that they believe is in the Arctic Ocean, but it's a substantial amount.
Hi, sweetie.
Who's that?
Who's that?
That's my dog, and oh. I'm going to go let him outside real quick.
Okay.
But, you know, I mean, we have so many natural resources. I really don't see any reason to continue going on this path of fossil fuel consumption when we can do so much other energy generation from wind or solar or hydroelectric. There's so many other sources that we can be doing and moving ourselves away from this dependency on fossil fuels. I just think it's the wrong direction to go to in general. And I think the amount of oil, even if you know, depending on how much is there, it's still going to only be a temporary amount that we can use, and eventually we're going to have to go to alternative energies anyways. And why not do it now?
Mm-hmm. And what does it do? Has your center looked at the effect that it would have on polar bears, on seals, on other species?
No, we don't actually have any ecologists or biologists at our center that actually look at these sort of impact studies. So any news that we get are from other colleagues at different institutions.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not our direct area of expertise.
Thanks so much, Jackie, for your call. Let's go to Frank from Madison. Hi, Frank.
Hello. Could I ask a technical question of your fine guest and then comment on some species that live in Antarctica?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't this doubly ominous in that if the sea ice goes, it's gone? Is there a nucleation effect that since there's no ice up there, the dynamic will change permanently, and there's a reduction in the albedo, so that the heating is going to proceed more rapidly. And then the second point is that in Antarctica, there are species like those really cute Adelie penguins that are dependent upon the ice shelf, mm-hmm. which is disappearing, and so they are losing out to penguins that don't need an ice shelf to breed.
Mm.
And the ice shelf is also the nurturing location for young krill. So as it disappears, the krill disappear, and the krill are at the base of an entire ecosystem. So it's very ominous, this type of thing. And then finally, the adaptive response that we will have to the disappearance of the ice is to drill for oil up there. So, we're not the most intuitive species. So thank you.
Thank you, Frank. Thanks for the call.
Well, it's true that, it's a little bit ominous in that the sea ice helps to keep our planet cool because it's very reflective. It reflects most of the incoming solar radiation from the sun right back out to space. And this is true for the snow cover as well. So when you start reducing the sea ice and you start reducing the amount of snow cover on the planet, you then allow the darker surfaces like the ocean surface or the land to start absorbing that energy from the sun, which then further melts more ice. So it's sort of this vicious positive feedback effect that you end up in. And what we know is that when you lose this ice, you're going to warm the Arctic even further. So you're going to even have more dramatic changes. And I think one of the concerns that we haven't really addressed yet, because we don't have a whole lot of knowledge about it yet, is when that permafrost starts thawing and all those critters start becoming active, they estimate there's about 950 gigatons of carbon in the permafrost up in the Arctic. So when that starts to thaw because you're warming the environment because you've lost all the ice that was reflecting that energy from the sun back out to space, that's a huge carbon load that's about to go back up in the atmosphere as well. So it's going to further compound the warming that we're already seeing. And these are some of these feedback effects that we're just now starting to understand even better, and I don't think a lot of the climate models have been able to quite get a grasp on what that feedback effect is going to be when we start warming that environment even further. And I know in the Antarctic, I have a colleague of mine who was recently doing some work on the penguins, on the Adelie penguins, and there was this warming event that happened in the sort of 1970s, and it reduced their population by half. And now it's stabilized again, that population, but some of the climate models are saying, okay, well, you're going to start having even more warming, which is then going to impact those penguin populations even more again. That's about to come. There's a little bit of uncertainty right now in the Antarctic because the models are a little bit inconsistent with their responses, and part of it is that the warming in the Antarctic that we're going to observe is first happening sort of on the Antarctic Peninsula area, but other parts of the Antarctic are actually cooling right now. And some of this we understand to be related to a strengthening of the wind patterns around Antarctica that actually help to increase winds that come down from the continental ice sheet and spread out over the ocean and help push the ice away and actually cause more new ice formation. So there's actually regions of the Antarctic that are growing ice, and there's other regions that are thinning. And so you have sort of two different competing effects right now in the Antarctic. And so certain penguin populations are actually okay right now, but the ones that are closer to the Antarctic Peninsula are the ones that are starting to show some signs of suffering.
And thanks very much for the call. We go next to Pete from La Crosse. Hi, Pete.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Julianne.
Hi.
It seems to me that we're mostly talking about sea ice melting due to atmospheric carbon dioxide. But what I wanted to talk about was sea ice melting due to maybe a modest amount, maybe a significant amount, I'm not sure, of dust collecting on the surface of the ice, dust that's coming from coal-fired power plants around the world,
mm-hmm.
from diesel engines, et cetera. We know from volcanoes and other natural experiments that dust travels very long ways. And I'm just wondering, is even a small amount of additional dust and soot on the surface of the ice sufficient to allow it to not reflect this radiation back into space and to be more prone to melting, totally aside from the damage being caused by the CO2 in the atmosphere?
Well, that's a good point, and it certainly is something that we know will, you know, if you increase the dust on the ice, it's going to help foster more surface melting. We do know this to be the case, and there are colleagues that have been looking at just the increase even in forest fires in Canada, for example, and how that's been influencing the timing of the ice melt. And they have been showing a pretty good correlation with increased soot and earlier melting and earlier disappearance of the ice. You know, in terms of trying to separate out, you know, how much of it is due to increased soot content on the ice, how much of it is due to increased atmospheric temperatures, how much of it is due to increased ocean temperatures, it's really hard to separate out all those competing effects. So I can't say, you know, well, X percent would be due to dust and X percent would be due to rising temperatures. You know, these are all factors certainly that are contributing to speeding up the ice melt.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more? You spent a few minutes talking about the penguins. You have said that the changing temperatures and conditions, we're not sure as much how they will play out in more southerly latitudes, the area that science needs to go into next. We really don't know what this is all going to mean. Obviously, it's all connected. What happens in one area will have an effect on what happens in another area. Are scientists starting to move more into that part of the world? Do we have a better understanding now than we did?
I think we have a better understanding now that we did, and even a study that we did, I guess it's almost 2 years ago now, where we looked at comparing the climate models with the actual observations up in the Arctic. You know, we learned a lot of lessons from that, and so people that are doing the modeling development are going back and trying to make changes to sort of help do a better job at simulating real-world conditions, because until we can really simulate what's happening today, it's harder to predict what's going to happen in the future. And so they're always going back and trying to refine their models with better physics and better resolution so they can handle small-scale features better in the models. I think the Antarctic has been, the models aren't as consistent in terms of at least the sea ice cover in the Antarctic, mm. which is the region that I've been looking at, whereas in the Arctic they're actually very consistent with each other and that at least they're all in qualitative agreement with each other that the ice is disappearing. But, yeah, the Antarctic right now is, it's a whole different environment because, you know, when you're up in the Arctic is surrounded by land, and we're controlled a lot by land influences as well as ocean influences, whereas the Antarctic is completely influenced by the ocean, and it was going to respond very differently to warming than what we're seeing in the northern latitudes.
Let's welcome more phone calls, and we go next to Dave from Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Dave.
Good morning, Kathleen, and good morning to your guest. Very interesting program. Not to put too fine a point on it, but it seems to me that the people who have been pushing our energy policies over the most recent years and for some time past beyond that have a big stake in the oil company, the oil industry, and it seems as though those people were also dead set against increasing CAFE standards for cars and producing the cars that people now, of course, find out that they need. It should have started back when Jimmy Carter suggested it in 73. But given the state of the science on global warming, and there, obviously there are people who deny it, the new Republican vice president, presidential nominee seems to be, but let us assume that global warming is a myth and it's really not happening. The things that we would need to do to at least bring it to a halt and possibly reverse it would be good for us anyway. If we were to pump all the oil, the available oil, out of our continental shelf, it's still a finite resource, and we would still need to import oil from what we call our enemies, at least enemies we have managed to make. With the melting of the polar ice, I can see, for example, oil tankers running from Murmansk right straight across the top of the Earth and perhaps hitting a stray iceberg here and there, and imagine what the potential for contamination and pollution of somewhat at least pure or reasonably clean ocean water now in the wildlife, the flora and fauna that depends upon it. So I think the case has to be made that what we need to do would be good for us. Now, also, we have to remember, I don't know whose quote it is, but the quote goes something like, before you try to change other people's habits, just imagine the problems that you have changing your own habits when you know it would be good for you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my comment, and I'd like to hear.
Thank you, Dave.
Response. Thank you.
Okay.
Very
yeah.
Much.
Thanks for the call, Professor Struve.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think going and drilling for oil is completely the wrong direction that we need to be heading in. It is a finite resource, and you know it's going to be finite anywhere in the world eventually. So, you know, there's no reason for us not to start doing the right thing. We know that a lot of our practices not only help warm the planet, but they're also polluting our environment. And why not start moving towards best practices that give us a really clean and, you know, healthy environment to live in, and not just for us, but for all species on the planet. Everything is connected. And I think people don't realize, you know, you change one part of the environment, the rest of the planet's going to respond. You know, everything is interconnected, and so we need to take good care of it. It's the only one we have.
Mm. Thanks, Dave, for the call. Tim from Ladysmith, hi. Hello, Tim. Tim is gone. Let's go to Louis from Wausau. Hi, Louis.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. I would like to take maybe a minute just to toss out some numbers about the real situation with oil. Hello, am I on?
Oh, yeah, you are.
First of all, something everybody should know is that every oil rig in the world is operating, is contracted for the end of next year. All the new rigs are sold out until 2013. And when we say drill now, what we mean is 5 years from now. That's the earliest a new oil rig could be put in place. There are two areas in the United States that are currently under bans or moratoriums. One is the Anwar in Alaska, and the other is the Outer Continental Shelf, which is a huge area all around Alaska, all around the country. We use 20 million barrels of oil a day. The world uses 80 billion. The amount of oil that would be produced in 8 or 10 years on the Outer Continental Shelf is about 200,000 barrels of oil a day. I guess I should back up and say these numbers come from the Department of Energy Information Agency, the U.S. government, which studies these things and gets them pretty much right. Anyway, so 200,000 barrels a day compared to 20 million that we use is not very much. The DOE, Department of Energy, estimates, well, their exact words are, because this oil goes on the international market, the effect on oil prices will be insignificant. And the effect on imported oil, for example, we import 10 million barrels a day. 200,000 is not going to make much of a dent in that.
Mm-hmm.
And the Anwar, now even John McCain is opposed to opening up the Anwar. The Anwar is a little different because all the oil is in one place. This Outer Continental Shelf stuff is very difficult. It's out 50 miles in the ocean, in sometimes a mile or two of water, and so on. It's just a very difficult thing, and that's why it takes so long to get to it and why so little is produced even in 20 years from now. But the Anwar is different. It's all in one place.
Right.
And that could be 700,000 barrels a day in 20 years from now. But even that, that will make a significant difference on oil prices. It will make a difference of 1.5 cents, a penny and a half gasoline at the pump. So those are the numbers quickly. I could go on for 2 hours, but I don't think you want me to do that, not right now anyway.
Yeah, I don't think we have time
but
for that.
But the point is that drilling now means 5 years from now, the oil will start in 8 years from now and will become significant 20 years from now. We'll make no difference on imported oil, not much of a dent anyway, very, very small. And a penny and a half difference a gallon of gasoline.
Professor Struve.
Well, I really appreciate getting to hear some of those numbers because I'm not up to date on all the numbers as to how much oil is there and how much we're actually importing. So that was really useful information. The one thing I think is, well, I went to this meeting in Norway back in May, and it was this Energy Climate Technology Conference. And they had people from all different areas. So they had offshore drilling people. They also had offshore wind production people. Hydroelectric people. So there was a lot of different energy producers. And the one thing I thought when I listened to one guy speak about drilling in the Arctic and talking about all the difficulties in designing rigs to withstand the harsh conditions that you're going to be facing up in the Arctic, it just seemed, you know, so futile. It just seemed like, you know, why do you want to spend all this money and all this investment trying to get that little bit of oil that's out there? I mean, I guess it's still economically viable, I guess, because the people that are doing this are still making tons of money. But it just seems like we could be spending that money in such a better way. We could be moving towards renewable energies and putting the money there. That makes so much more sense, because eventually you're going to run out of that oil anyways.
Professor Julian Struve is our guest, research scientist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center. She's doing research on diagnosing the significantly declining Arctic sea ice cover using modeling and observation data. Last week from her organization came reports that Arctic sea ice is melting at an alarming rate, and the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Colorado released its latest ice report last week showing ice coverage in the region is at its second lowest level in 30 years. We're talking about that this hour. We have a couple lines open if you've been trying to get through. It's 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, or send an email if you'd like at talk@wpr.org. Louis from Wausau, thanks for your call. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls for Professor Julian Struve. She is research scientist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Colorado. And we go to Fred from Watersmeet. Hi, Fred.
Hi. A couple of comments. First of all, I'm real sympathetic, you know, on the effect of what global warming is going to have on the animals. But what doesn't seem to be getting much press or addressed is what the effect is going to be on the way of life of the Native Americans up there, specifically the Inuit. Their whole way of life is going to be destroyed. The second comment is, and I'm not this up on it, but I just wonder if the ice does disappear, are there other minerals there that could be extracted a lot easier without the ice cover there? Those are my two comments. Thank you.
Thank you for the call.
Well, certainly the way of life of the indigenous people up in the Arctic has already been quite impacted by the changes going on. You know, certainly, but you know, their way of life is tied, of course, to all the animals up in the Arctic. And so as the animals change their migration patterns in response to changing atmospheric and oceanic and environmental conditions, you know, they're having to change, of course, how they access their food because, you know, for example, whales near Barrow, Alaska that they were hunting are now going much further north, much further towards the pole, as the waters get warmer and warmer, coming through the Bering Strait, for example. And certainly, you know, the hunters in the up in Alaska and Canada, they need the ice, of course, to go out and hunt for seals as well. And if the ice has been breaking up earlier, they don't go out as safely as they used to. They're having to change their whole ways of knowing about the ice conditions because their old indicators of what they knew about weather and what they knew about the ice are changing, and so they can't rely on sort of their historical knowledge of the ice conditions or the weather patterns, because everything's really changing, and they're having to revise how they actually go out and hunt for the ice, and they might have to travel a lot farther than they used to access their food. I know even another impact that they've been going through lately is that because the permafrost is thawing, they used to be able to store their food underground, and now they're actually having to buy refrigerators like the rest of us to store their food, for example, because they can't rely on that frozen ground anymore. So there's all kinds of changes impacting them. There's a lot of sort of their highways in the Canada and part of Alaska, too, are based on frozen riverways, and those are changing. So their access to go out, sort of they use these rivers as their highways to access different locations, that's even changing as well. So there's a lot of effects for them, and I know that new species are appearing that they never had words for. They've seen robins up in Barrow, and they never had a word for that sort of a bird species.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. So things are changing quite dramatically up there.
We go to Joe from Minneapolis next. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Two real quick questions. First, if the professor is willing to comment on broader climate change models, could you just maybe give a brief overview of what the new range of possibilities would be maybe in the next 50 to 500 years? And also, if she feels it's appropriate, what's the attitude among scientists regarding our political will to change? I know I'm personally very pessimistic that we'll do anything until it's 100 degrees every day in January in Minnesota, but are scientists hopeful that we will have the political will to change or make the necessary changes, or is it just kind of a cynical world like I live in? Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Oh, wait, now I forgot the first question. I was thinking about the second question there. So I did forget the first question. Do you remember, Catherine?
Do you have scientific projections?
Oh,
is there
right.
consensus 50 to 500 years?
Right. Well, we know that, you know, the projections are we will lose that ice cover if we continue business as usual, which at this point, that's what we are doing.
Mm.
So we will lose the sea ice. In terms of how that's going to impact, say, us here in the lower latitudes, you know, that's a little bit unsure. We do run climate models, and some of them give different results than others. One of the consistent results that we do see, for example, is that the America Southwest is going to dry quite a bit. We're going to see a lot less snowfall, a lot less rainfall. So that's one sort of consistent result that these models are giving. Another consistent result that we've been seeing is that southwestern Europe is going to get a lot wetter, for example. So you can imagine, you know, because our atmospheric circulation is driven by the temperature contrast between the poles and the equator, and if you change the temperature of the poles and you warm it, you change that temperature contrast. And so all your weather patterns are going to have to readjust to this sort of new temperature contrast between the poles and the equator. And so we know everything is going to change. I think what you're going to start seeing is a big change in the water distribution around this planet. So some areas are going to get drier and hotter, and some places might get wetter and perhaps even cooler. So the distribution of water is going to change. And in terms of, you know, being pessimistic about, you know, our country and what we're going to be doing, I am a little disappointed, actually, in both parties right now that they're not really sort of addressing the idea of going towards renewable energy sources. I'm hearing from both camps, offshore oil drilling and nuclear energy.
Mm-hmm.
And I just feel like, you know, we need leadership to bring us into sort of the new region that we need to go in, and that's renewable energy. And I don't see either party doing that right now. I'm thinking they're trying to play to get certain votes, and so it's really unclear, you know, what direction would they really head in when they actually got the presidency. But I am a little disappointed right now that our country seems to be behind the times on this. You know, when you go to Europe, and my European colleagues and even their governments, they're really being more proactive about trying to make changes. And
most of the world is, really, aren't they? Most of the world is there.
Yeah, and I guess I'm discouraged, too, and I think that big business, big industry is what's running our government. And so I don't know how much power a new leader will have to change that structure of power in our country. And that's obviously what needs to get changed.
Jonathan from Appleton is next. Hi, Jonathan.
Good morning. Thank you for the program.
Sure.
How much ice are we talking about here? You know, is it 4 Olympic-sized swimming pools? And then if it is this huge amount, where is that change being? Where are we finding that? Are there increased sea levels someplace? You know, why isn't Greenland completely underwater by now? I'll take my answers off the air.
Okay.
Thank you. Have a grateful day.
Thanks.
I'm sorry, he'll take his answers off the air? Or?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Oh, wait, so you want me to respond to that right now?
Sure.
Okay.
Go right ahead.
So, you know, what we're talking about right now, of course, is a floating ocean ice cover. So that what forms in the ocean. So when you melt that, you're not going to be raising sea levels because it's like an ice cube floating in a glass of water. But you can have an indirect effect on the glaciers and Greenland, for example, mm-hmm. in that you're warm in the Arctic. And the one thing we do know is that the melt rates in Greenland have been increasing at the same time as we've been seeing the loss of the sea ice cover. So they're happening at the same time. They're probably responding to the same sort of forcing, and that's rising atmospheric temperatures, for example. But, you know, in terms of how the loss of sea ice could further amplify that warming, we're starting to see effects of that. We're starting to see disintegration of ice shelves that are floating on the ocean, for example. And if we continue to warm the Arctic, we're going to definitely start increasing the melt in Greenland. And when we did our earlier sea level projections that were put in the latest IPCC report that was released in 2007, you know, a lot of the dynamics and how Greenland is responding weren't in there because the science has been pretty new. It's responding a lot quicker than we anticipated, and we're still trying to revise our understanding of why Greenland is showing such much more rapid melt, and the glaciers are accelerating a lot faster than we thought that they would be doing under a warming climate. So we've been a bit conservative, actually, in our estimates, and we're seeing much quicker response in Greenland than we had seen in the past.
And thanks, Jonathan, very much for the call. We go to Hugh from Eau Claire next. Hi, Hugh.
Hi. I'm a truck driver. I'm just passing through by Eau Claire here. Uh-huh. Well, I was just wondering there, like, they have these programs all the time there, as everything is global warming there, but you never get anybody with another view. Like, a lot of them are dismissed as a few rogue scientists, but there is a website called petitionproject.org that has 31,000 scientists, including 9,400 PhDs, that refute the theory of global warming, and which includes the founder of the Weather Channel. And then you have guys like Al Gore and the guys who are promoting this global warming stuff there that have their own private jets, big houses, and SUVs that do not practice what they preach. You know, I'm a little confused.
Professor?
Well, I think the one thing that's important for the general public to understand is climate does not change without a forcing on it. So if the skeptics are saying that it's not being caused by greenhouse gases, then, you know, they haven't been able to come up with the alternative forcing. They cannot describe what we're going through today by any other thing. And so it's interesting, you know, in the past when you have your glacier to interglacier periods, it's being driven by changes of the Earth's orbit relative to the sun. And so we know this, and we've seen these huge climate fluctuations happen because of that. The warming that we're going through today is on the same order of magnitude as when you're coming out of an ice age. It's just that we're doing it again. We're doing it on top of what we already were coming out of in terms of that warming. And the warming is happening faster than we've ever seen in the past. So what's interesting is that, you know, if the skeptics are wanting to say it's not greenhouse gases, that humans have no effect on their environment, which to me, I can't really fathom. When you have nearly 1 billion people on the planet in 1850, and we're now nearly 7 billion people, and we changed the total landscape of this planet, we cut down the forests, we put up cities, we put up agricultural fields, we changed our local climate, and we put different gases in the atmosphere, and we pollute our rivers and air. It's just, how are you not having an impact? You know, if they want to come up with an alternative forcing that can explain what's happening, you know, I think scientists would listen, but there hasn't been anything that anybody's been able to come up with that can explain the warming that we're going through. Mm. Greenhouse gases comes closest, and until somebody comes up with a better forcing, mm-hmm. I guess that's what we have right now.
Thanks, Hugh, for the call. We have time for one more call, about a minute left. Hi, Catherine from Chicago.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. I wondered if you or the professor had seen the documentary Crude Awakenings.
I haven't, no. Have you seen it?
No, I have not either.
I think you should see it. I think everyone should see it. If it's fair and if it's correct, it really tells us about all of the things that we could do, but it's really just a drop in the bucket, all the different kinds of renewable energies or the shale mining in Canada or the drilling in Alaska. Is such a drop in the bucket. And one of the reasons is the ever-growing economies of China and India and the huge demand that they are placing on the world with the use of oil. And as their economies continue to, you know, this rapid growth, they're using so much oil. And I'm wondering how this can be addressed. It's really becoming a little lopsided in the world.
I would just take one counterpoint to that, and that is that in terms of energy consumption per person and oil consumption per person in the world, the U.S. dominates that. So, yes, these countries are coming up, and they are going to start consuming a lot more, and they're going to start emitting a lot more. And that doesn't mean that we don't need to also, you know, help them reduce their emissions. But it's got to start here, too. We need to be leaders and show the world the way in some ways, because we are the largest energy consumers per person on the planet. And while we can go towards renewable energy sources, you make a good point in that we also need to conserve more, and we need to reduce our energy consumption. I think that's a big factor. We need to move towards conservation.
Mm. And we're out of time. I thank you so much, Professor Julian Struva, for being with us. It was a fascinating article.
You're welcome.
And an important hour, I think. She is research scientist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center, doing research on the diagnosis of the declining Arctic sea ice cover, which is disappearing quite rapidly, alarmingly so. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be with you again tomorrow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.